for a lot of the key construction inputs, prices were higher in low-income countries, which is very striking because these are the countries that are going to build up their infrastructure.
Welcome to Vox Dev Talks. My name is Tim Phillips. Policymakers and politicians love to talk about investing in domestic infrastructure, why it's going to grow the economy, also how it's going to provide jobs and strengthen firms, and how their policies are going to encourage it. What's the best way to invest in infrastructure to realise these goals? Martina Kirchberger of Trinity College Dublin is an expert on this topic. She joins me now. Martina, welcome to Vox Dev Talks.
Thanks, Tim. It's great to be here.
Martina, how important is infrastructure for growth? I suppose, what do we mean by infrastructure?
Let me start by defining what I mean by infrastructure. And I typically have in mind the core arteries of an economy. So think of the roads, the bridges, the highways, airports, and supportive infrastructure, electricity, water, sewage systems. And then there is social infrastructure, buildings that are used as hospitals, as schools. Mm-hmm. And all of these are built by the construction sector. How important infrastructure is for growth? That's a harder question in many ways. Countries that are very good at providing good infrastructure do a lot of things differently. And so from an identification perspective, it's very hard to say country grew faster because of the infrastructure, because of all these other policies that are implemented in different ways. What we know from a host of studies that have been done over the past decades, very careful micro evaluations, is that when we think about specific infrastructure projects, it's very context specific and it depends on the type of infrastructure we're thinking about. Is this a rural road versus an urban transit system? I think there's very careful work that has been going into identifying these micro level effects. But I think at an aggregate level, the complementarities between infrastructure and other parts of the economy have long been recognized, going back to Hirschman. And infrastructure and construction sector goods are very particular in the sense that they're inputs into other types of production processes. So they're very central. There are a lot of complementary private and public investments. And so they're sort of key to enable economic activity in all kinds of other sectors. At the same time, they're also a source of wasteful spending. And so historically, we also know that there are roads built to nowhere. And so I think getting the spending right is really important.
Okay, let me ask you probably a slightly easier question, a more national accounting question. The construction of this infrastructure, the construction sector, what proportion of investment is that?
The construction sector accounts for about half of investment, so gross fixed capital formation. Mm-hmm. And then within construction, we have three big groups. We have residential construction, non-residential, and then civil engineering works. And on average, that split is about 40-30-30. So the infrastructure piece would be typically in the civil works fraction then of construction. But it's a huge part of investment that we typically don't spend a lot of time studying.
Especially considering the scale of it that you just explained to me. Now, policymakers, they think about the construction sector often as instrumental, a way to achieve their other policy goals. What policy goals are they thinking of?
They have a number of goals in mind. First, when they build a new piece of infrastructure, there is sort of the bodies employed in the construction. So the jobs that are being created are considered something that's valuable. And you could also count the employment created in upstream firms that supply to a particular construction project. Second, if you think about a particular type of infrastructure investment, for example, an express train, there are direct jobs that are being then created. Because of this infrastructure, there are conductors are needed. There might be employment opportunities that are directly created there. For example, on platforms, you might have little shops. So vendors can set up small stalls. You need to maintain the infrastructure. And then, of course, there are the jobs that we think are enabled through the infrastructure. So a decrease in transport costs enables better matching between workers and firms, and that improves productivity. So there's this, all these multiple objectives that I think often policymakers have in mind to reach when they invest in infrastructure.
And we're going to talk about several pieces of work that you've done around this. Really interesting pieces of work and the sorts of things that I don't think I've ever seen in development economics before. So we'll talk about those in a second. So first of all, Martina, for the first time ever on Vox Dev Talks, we're going to talk about cement because you have done a piece of work on this. Now, does every country, first of all, does every country have its own cement industry?
To answer this question, it's useful to distinguish between two main types of plants, and I promise I won't go much further into how we...
I want to know the details.
So there are grinding and then there are integrated cement plants. And so an integrated cement plant takes limestone and then adds some clay, and this gets put into a very hot oven, a kiln, at about 2,000 degrees. And out of that comes clinker. And so in the final stage, that clinker gets ground. And so an integrated cement plant does all of these things and produces cement, which is the gray powder. Grinding plants only do that last step. They take clinker and they ground it into cement. So the technologies of these two plants are very different. The distinction is relevant because the availability of local limestone determines what type of plants countries have. And so many countries would have a combination of those two plants, depending on the economic geography and where cement is needed and their geological resources. And then some countries would only have, for example, grinding plants. So Cote d'Ivoire only has grinding plants due to lack of natural limestone. Limestone you wouldn't ship across countries because it's just very heavy and has low value compared to its weight. Bangladesh has mainly grinding plants with a few integrated plants. And then there are some countries that don't have any plants. So, for example, Cape Verde doesn't have any operating plants at the moment. And so if we think about cement trade, it's worthwhile noting that only 5% of global consumption is traded. So it's still largely a non-tradable good at an aggregate level. While it's certainly important for certain countries to import cement, only 5% is traded.
Because it's pretty heavy stuff, I remember from carrying it around.
It's heavy and it's a hydraulic binder. So you imagine with humidity, it's also not straightforward to transport over. Of course, you can do it, but I think all of these factors play into the fact that it's just trade is fairly small.
This is an education. You collected data on these cement prices. For which countries did you collect the data? How did you collect this data?
So we used data from the International Comparison Project that's housed by the ICP. And the ICP did a change in 2011 in the way they collect prices to compute the construction sector PPP. They had an output-based approach where they would price certain construction components, and they moved to an input-based approach, which was great because they were very careful in specifying the quantity and quality of key construction sector inputs. And I've looked at this for a long time, thinking about the cost of construction across countries, and it's just very difficult to compare because products are so heterogeneous. It's just very hard to compare unit costs across countries. But for inputs, you can do this. For example, cement is defined as a ton of Portland cement, which is a precise definition. For concrete, it's the mix between sand, cement, and aggregates, and the proportions are specified as well as the size of the aggregate and the compressive strength of that ready-mix concrete. And so when we compare these prices, we really compare similar products. Surely there'll be we can't rule out that there are any quality differences left, but we need this in order to be able to start comparing prices. So we started looking at these prices. We were very excited to get access to these data, and we saw large differences. We saw that for a lot of the key construction inputs, prices were higher in low-income countries, which is very striking because these are the countries that are going to build up their infrastructure massively. And so if they pay very high prices for these key inputs, then that's an important bottleneck that we should think about.
And it's completely counterintuitive to think that prices should be higher. We'll work out why that is a little bit later. Which countries were you able to get the data on?
We have a large set. We have over 100 countries. This is really, we get a good distribution of these prices at a global level.
Cement in these countries, it's more expensive than it is in a high-income country in the United States or in the UK where I am.
Yeah, so if we look at 2011 prices, for example, in sub-Saharan Africa, the average price was $260 compared to North America, where it was $190,
wow.
And East Asia and the Pacific, $115. But there's large differences even within, say, sub-Saharan Africa. So we looked at the 10 most expensive countries in 2011, and 9 of these 10 were in sub-Saharan Africa. And so, for example, in the Central African Republic, price per ton of cement was close to $500 compared to the prices in the US, $190. Even in 2017, prices have come down, but still the price is twice as high as it is in the US. And in PPP terms, so taking local price levels into account, 4.5 times. And this negative relationship between prices and development persists. So prices are higher in the poorest countries for many of these key inputs.
The question on the mind of absolutely everyone that's hearing this now, why so expensive?
So we looked at the cost of inputs as one of the explanations. It could be expensive because the inputs are expensive. It could be because demand is below minimum efficient scale, so these plants just can't produce at a scale that's efficient.
Mm-hmm.
Technology might be low, or markups could be high. And this is when we started thinking about what the market structure looks in these countries. And we started digitizing data on the global distribution of cement plants and firms to get a sense of what competition looks like. And what we find in the paper is that using the distribution of limestone deposits for some exogenous variation that affects the number of firms, prices are significantly higher in countries where there are fewer firms.
Does this affect, I imagine it must do because cement is a very important input, this affects the price of the infrastructure in these countries?
Well, cement is a substantial fraction of construction sector expenditures, particularly for the poorest countries.
Yeah.
It's not the case for the rich countries where it's used abundantly and it's cheap. The median that we computed was 8%, and at the 75th percentile, it's 17%. So we've also looked at ICP data on construction components, and we see that construction components that use concrete are more expensive when cement prices are high. So there seems to be this very clear path through. What's really important is that when we think about the cost of this infrastructure, to keep in mind the production network. So here, an input into the production of lots of other goods that's very central in the production network
mm-hmm.
is very expensive. And so the dynamic implications are going to be much larger than just the static implications.
Seeing as there are these excess profits clearly being made, why is there not more competition in these markets?
Since we started looking at the data in 2011, there has been entry in this market and prices have come down. But there are policies in place that limit competition. So, for example, restrictive product standards, import bans or restrictions on imports, also lack of transparency in how licenses for the exploration of limestone deposits and production is awarded. That's not something we distinguish in the paper, in the work that I've done, what the main drivers are for this, but this is what's being mentioned when you read literature on the state of competition in this industry.
I would have thought the policy remedies to fix this, which would probably, from what we've discussed before, be very positive for the economy, would be to reverse some of these restrictive practices. Is that right?
Yeah, and there are competition authorities very active in some of these countries, and it calls for an active role of those. I think what's still important to keep in mind is this is a hard problem. Cement cartels or cartels in concrete are being discovered across the world in countries at very high levels of income. It's just a difficult problem to solve. 2019 in the UK, for example, you had discovery and fines of a cartel. So we should keep this in mind.
Okay, so secondly, you've also investigated the links between construction and labor jobs. Now, it's always assumed that construction is a source of jobs in the formal sector. Is this particularly relevant in developing countries?
Yeah, because there's huge pressure to create jobs. So there's a 40% increase in the working age population in sub-Saharan Africa between 2018 and 2035. So policymakers are faced with this pressure to create employment. And the construction sector particularly construction of large projects, has this potential of create jobs in the formal sector, which are believed to be jobs that are valued by people. Policymakers have this idea that when they invest in these projects, they create valuable jobs that allow workers potentially to climb the job ladder, acquire human capital, and then move onto a different trajectory.
That's a prior belief that many people would share, but do we have strong empirical evidence that this is true, that construction does create these jobs?
I don't think we have. And this was part of the motivation for why we started this work. We were talking with policymakers, and they were excited to find this out too, because their prior was that we're creating very good jobs here and that benefit people. And we don't have evidence from even other contexts that these jobs create opportunities that workers beyond the completion of a construction project, they can take the human capital they've acquired to a different jobs, and that allows them to grow their earnings over time.
So in your paper, it's called Constructing Africa's Cities, you created an RCT to test this, the effect of a formal job offer in the construction sector. Where did you do this? For what construction project?
The construction project was the bus rapid transit system that was being built in Dakar in Senegal. It's up and running now and fantastic. And we collaborated with the government, donors, and the construction firm to understand what happens to workers who are employed in the construction of this infrastructure. So we designed an RCT where workers could sign up at different lists, either in the communities or at the company's headquarters. And then we randomized who would get a job offer. And we interviewed people at baseline, and then for 12 rounds, and then we conduct an end line.
Right. And what offer did, I suppose, the lucky recipients get?
So they get an offer for a 3-month contract. It's a formal sector contract with a multinational firm that has a base salary, their transport premium, and then there's paid overtime.
Okay.
The contract is, in theory, renewable, but it's limited to this 3-month contract.
And so what was the immediate effect for the people who did get a contract?
We see immediate effects in the first 3 months that people are more likely to be working. In the previous 7 days when we called them, they're working longer days, more days, and they're working more hours. But we don't see any effect on earning, for example.
Ah, interesting. Why do you not see an effect on earning?
It could be because their outside option is not giving them a very different salary from what they get paid in this work.
Okay, but we did see those effects on the likelihood that they would be working. Does this persist after the 3 months?
So we see very little persistence. At end line, these workers, in many outcomes, don't look different from the control group. And we're still looking into heterogeneity according to education or match quality based on whether they had experience in the construction sector before. But the evidence so far does not suggest that these workers are in a substantially different trajectory. We see a little bit of suggestive evidence in terms of having social security or health insurance, but we need to look more into transitions and to heterogeneity to get a fuller picture.
Now, this somewhat undermines this prior belief that construction is creating these job opportunities. Why is this not working? Can policy do anything to make this more of an opportunity for these workers?
At the moment, I can only speculate. I think part of it is that the salaries were fairly low. As a potential explanation, the duration of these contracts was also fairly short in comparison to what these workers are engaged in, where a large proportion engages in daily labor, where they get paid at a daily rate. 3 months is long. But in terms of the possibility to progress within a firm, having this fixed term duration is relatively short. And that's a characteristic of the sector, is that a lot of these contracts would be for the duration of the construction. So if we compare this, for example, with a manufacturing firm that's sort of fixed in space, the incentives to invest and to progress within a firm are different here when workers hold a contract that's short term or even for the construction duration. There could also be language barriers. And we see this in other parts of the world. There's evidence that there are language barriers that prevent human capital spillovers. What we do in another project is we also work with a construction firm, and we implemented a training that we developed with psychologists in non-cognitive skills, and particularly conscientiousness. And there we see big effects on earnings and retention of workers that were trained. So I think for policymakers, it is important to think about what complementary interventions could be implemented to increase the value of these jobs that are created in the construction of the infrastructure.
So in the third stop of our tour through the construction industry here, we talk about firms. By their nature, we assume that constructing buildings or roads or bridges is a domestic activity because you can't construct them and then move them into place. In low middle income countries, is it?
It is true that construction typically is considered as a classical domestic or non-tradable industry. And this is how I was trained too. I think the picture is very different when you spend time in low-income countries. You can see global firms constructing all kinds of infrastructure, large buildings. They're truly global. They come from everywhere. And so I think this is something that you see very clearly when you spend time there. But I don't think there is a lot of good evidence that quantifies these flows at a systematic level or thinks about the implications.
Now, you're working to compile that evidence. What do we know from your work about the location of firms that are delivering these construction projects?
We know very little because it's a very hard measurement problem. In a previous book chapter, I looked at prior review contracts by the World Bank in a period of 2004 to 2018 and looked at where the firms that carry out civil work contracts are registered. And you can see for Sub-Saharan Africa, for example, for contracts that are higher than $2 million, about 50% of these contracts are carried out by firms that are registered outside the region. Mm-hmm. That doesn't mean that they're domestic, they're outside Sub-Saharan Africa. For contracts above $50 million, that's 75% of contracts carried out by firms registered outside the region. In a new project, we want to get systematic evidence on who these global contractors are and where they work. We digitized lists on the top 225 global contractors and where they worked over a long period of time. And what we see is that, for example, in 2003, the top 10 firms are all from high-income countries, while in 2023, 40% of these top 10 firms are from China. China's revenue share increased by 5 times over those periods, whereas the US's share, for example, is a third. This is interesting because it also relates to some of the findings that we have from the US construction industry and the weak productivity growth. So not only is there weak productivity growth domestically, but also their importance at a global level has really decreased over the period that we're looking at. And again, we see there's very little participation of low-income countries. So there are no contractors on that list that come from low-income countries. So very little regional integration.
Why has China become so much more active, especially in those low-income countries?
They have a lot of experience they can draw on, uh-huh, on building up infrastructure efficiently. They're very competitive bidders, and that's for a number of reasons. There might be other links too, that infrastructure might be linked to natural resources or finance. So it's a number of reasons that has contributed to this large rise in China's participation of the construction of infrastructure.
Now, it strikes me that policymakers would really like to grow domestic construction firms if they could. If they wanted to do that, what options do they have to do it?
They could look back at China and how China used joint ventures to grow their domestic industries in a number of sectors. And I've seen this work really well in the construction sector too, where a foreign firm, when they carry out a project, they work with a local firm. They could stipulate the hiring of local workers because there are instances when even workers at lower levels of skills are brought into countries to complete infrastructure projects. Policymakers could stipulate using local suppliers. Now, these policy options, I'm listing them, but I don't think we have any evidence on what works well in the construction sector. So I think this is an area where it'd be very useful to generate more evidence, partnering up with governments. I think the evidence that we have from local content policies that were used predominantly in the exploration of natural resources is mixed. And so thinking about policies that are effective in construction would be very useful.
Martina, it's fascinating to get the detail on this and to also find out just how difficult it is to resolve some of these problems. Is it inevitably a trade-off between the need to create infrastructure and do it quickly and these broader policy goals to create competition and entry in these input markets, provide employment, stimulate domestic firms, which are difficult and take longer?
To some extent it is, and I think policymakers are very aware of these trade-offs. They often find themselves in highly congested environments, extremely polluted, and they need to put in place, say, transport infrastructure to allow the flow of people across locations. But I don't think it has to be that trade-off, because I think it's also a huge opportunity that they have. 90% of buildings to exist in Africa in 2040 are yet to be built. So there's going to be a lot of construction. McKinsey came out with a report this week that said there is an infrastructure financing need of $106 trillion. Wow. And so there is a lot of investment likely to be made in the future. So thinking about how to create some domestic construction industry and some spillovers from the projects that are being built, I think is really an important consideration. And here, a dynamic horizon is really important, thinking down the line. And what are the ways that construction industry could be stimulated so that some of this can be created locally?
A lot of open questions. Martina, thank you for talking about them.
Thank you so much for having me.
If you want to read about this research, you want to read about concrete thinking about development, that paper's Byrne and Kirchberger, 2021. Then also Constructing Africa's Cities, Labour Market Effects of Infrastructure Construction, authors Donovan, Kirchberger, Newman, Milosheva and Thorne. Cross-border flows in construction and their impact on low-income countries, authors Bernard, Kirchberger and Peters. And Martina, you did mention an earlier book chapter that I don't have in my list. What is that?
It's called The Role of the Construction Sector in Developing Countries, Some Key Issues.
Okay, thank you very much. This has been a Vox Dev Talk. The best way to make sure you don't miss an episode is follow us. You find us wherever you get your podcasts. Our past episodes, as always, are at voxdev.org, where you also find articles about the topics we discuss. And if you like what you're hearing, please tell someone else about us. Leave us a review as well. Vox Dev Talks is a Talk Normal production. The assistant producer is Megan Beaver and our editor is Andrei Zalgaria. Thanks to Oliver Hanni and Iman Siddiq at Vox Dev.